Well, thanks very much, Melissa, and thanks very much to the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia for the invitation to give this talk. I would very much have liked to be able to travel to Perth to do so in person as we'd originally planned, but it was not to be. Our nation is opening up, but mindful of the ongoing health risks, this is taking place in stages. The remaining restrictions on travel remind us that the pandemic is not over. The world is still facing a major public health challenge. The transition from pandemic to endemic is not straightforward. Even so, we are far enough along that transition that it is worth asking what the post-pandemic future might look like, even if the answer is not yet clearly in view. After any major global event such as this, it's natural to want things to go back to normal, to restore everything to the way it was before. At the same time, there's a countervailing tendency to believe that nothing will ever be the same again. And as often is the case, the truth is likely to be somewhere in the middle. As I touched on in another talk earlier in the year, in the face of a big shock, people and organisations adapt. In some cases, adapting to events sets your future on a different path. And this is the topic of my talk today: adaptation, innovation, and dynamism, and how the experience of the pandemic might have changed things. This is a central question for the shape of the post-pandemic future. Dynamism, the drive to innovate, adapt, and evolve, helps underpin a society's living standards. This question is especially salient at the current juncture. In the decade or so leading up to the pandemic, there was a nagging sense that these engines of prosperity were running out of steam. Investment was low, productivity growth was lagging, and many of the behaviours we associate with business dynamism were on the decline. These trends were evident across many advanced economies and spurred a debate about so-called secular stagnation. Australia was not immune to these trends. We did see a once-in-a-century boom in mining investment. Outside of mining, though, business investment declined as a share of the economy, especially after the global financial crisis. Even after the mining investment boom ended, non-mining business investment showed little sign of coming back. Instead, firms increasingly held on to cash, a trend that was also apparent globally, but especially in the case in Australia. Productivity growth is measured with a fair amount of noise, making the underlying trends hard to see. But there too, the trends in the post-GFC period were rather disappointing. Perhaps related to this, the measures of dynamism in the economy were also mostly below their historical trends. Entry rates for employing businesses were trending down, and so were exit rates. Abstracting from the effect of Uber and other self-employed drivers in the rideshare and other transport industries, business formation and exits were both lower post-crisis than they had been earlier this century. Business entry is an important part of dynamism because new firms are often innovators. Startups are seen as the firms with new ideas, new products, and new investment. Often new firms are small firms, and we know smaller firms account for an outsized share of business investment. In Australia, the top 1% of firms, there's about 17,000 of them, account for nearly 70% of production, but only half of all investment. Half of investment is that other 99% of firms that only account for 30% of production. That is not to say that existing firms don't innovate. Survey evidence shows that a significant and increasing fraction of firms engage in innovative activity and change their business models in any given year. Certainly, more firms are taking orders online, especially since the pandemic and associated lockdown started. But for all the talk of disruption, the overall sense one gets from the data is of a bit less dynamism or inclination to shake things up. The labour market shows a similar pattern. Job switching has trended down over several decades. Now, this need not be a bad thing. Some job changes aren't voluntary, as the spike during the early 1990s recession shows. But ABS surveys also show a trend decline in the share of workers who say they plan to leave their job to get a better job. This decreasing tendency to leave a job occurred at the same time that workers became increasingly fearful that they would lose a job. Our own research has shown that on average, workers systematically overestimate the chances they will lose their job over the coming year. That overestimation increases when economic conditions are weak and took a step up during the global financial crisis. One can't help but suspect that when people feel less secure, they are more inclined to hold on to what they have rather than take the risk of making the leap to something new and possibly better. These observations, less investment, less job and firm turnover, and less productivity growth, all suggest less adaptation and so a bit less dynamism. In combination, these shifts lend weight to the concerns about secular stagnation. They might also connect to some of the other patterns in the economy in the lead up to the pandemic. Low inflation, slow growth in wages, and a sense that very low interest rates were needed to stimulate demand in order to attain decent rates of economic growth. What could be causing this apparent lack of dynamism? And should we therefore be concerned about future growth potential and living standards? As always with complex phenomena emerging from the decisions and actions of many, the cause never boils just down to one thing, or even a couple of things. We can help our understanding, though, by ruling a few things out and by establishing that some things could only ever be a partial explanation. First, we should consider timing. Some of the trends I've mentioned have been relatively smooth over a number of decades, but quite a few saw a step change in the aftermath of the GFC. This suggests that we can't explain these outcomes entirely with long-run trends such as demographic change. There's some evidence that it might be one contributing factor, but it's unlikely to be the whole story. Second, Australia is not alone in seeing these trends. So we should not seek the causes entirely in Australian-specific developments such as regulatory change. There might be something Australian-specific going on. For example, wages growth was particularly weak relative to history in Australia compared with some other advanced economies. It's possible that some Australian-specific factor raised feelings of job insecurity, reduced job turnover, and thus dampened the factors that might otherwise support growth in wages. The psychology literature tells us that Australians are a bit more risk-averse on average than residents of some other English-speaking countries. But again, country-specific factors are unlikely to be the whole story. Explanations of the decline in these indicators of dynamism, such as investment or firm turnover, also need to be consistent with those other developments, low inflation and wages growth. It's difficult to explain reduced dynamism with a hypothesis that regulation increased labour costs, for example. If labour were too expensive, why wouldn't firms invest in labour-saving innovation? Instead, investment's been low. And if costs were rising for all firms, why weren't prices rising faster? I guess you could speculate instead about a misplaced perception that costs are too high, leading to downward pressure on growth in labour costs. If, as a result, labour becomes cheap relative to productivity, firms would have less need to invest because the payoff to labour-saving technology is lower. But even that hypothesis is a bit unsatisfying. It doesn't explain the lack of disruption. Why aren't more new firms coming in, willing to attract workers by paying higher wages and investing their way to higher productivity of that labour? So after all the digressions of what probably doesn't explain the situation we found ourselves in on the eve of the pandemic, I'd like to step through some possible explanations that look more fruitful. And they boil down to technology, incumbency, and risk. It sometimes seems hard to square observations of reduced dynamism and productivity growth with all the talk about disruption and the wave of amazing new technologies such as machine learning and related innovations. And they are pretty amazing. A parallel with the 1990s could be drawn. At that time, the economics profession was puzzling over the fact that, quote, you could see the computer age everywhere, but in the productivity statistics. It turns out that we just had to give them a bit more time. By the late 1990s, productivity was booming across many economies, including Australia. Personal computers and the internet did indeed hold a lot of promise. It simply took firms a while to work out how best to leverage them and to reorganise their processes and business models to reap the benefits. So in the face of unfamiliar technology, investment and productivity growth could well lag. And perhaps business formation does too, if people have to learn more about a technology before they start a business using it. The timing and cross-country nature of such a trend also fit the facts. So there is some merit to this explanation. If we were simply facing a repeat of the 1990s, that would not be a bad thing. We would just need to wait a while until everyone works out how to adapt to these new technologies. But I'm not convinced that the situation is quite so self-correcting this time. As I've noted before, the AI machine learning revolution is the first time that an apparent general purpose technology is actually harder to use and requires a higher and rarer set of skills to operate than the technologies it seeks to replace. This is not just an issue of having enough people with PhD level skills in designing the algorithms. Even scarcer is the wisdom and judgment to know when your algorithm has embedded an undesirable bias or has gone awry altogether. To the firms that do work out how to leverage new technologies, go the spoils. This is the message of an important strand of research on so-called superstar firms. By leveraging new technology and optimizing their structures, including across borders, these firms attract the most skilled workers and even more of the profits. The laggard firms, according to this hypothesis, survive by remaining low cost. So they get locked into a low wage, low investment groove. And because it's hard to know if you'll be the superstar and convince investors that you will be, business entry rates also fall. But this doesn't seem to be a benign story of the most productive firms winning out. Many industries are becoming more concentrated. At first glance, this might seem to be the result of productive firms outcompeting rivals. But a story of increasing competition is hard to square with other evidence of rising margins. And if the most productive firms were increasingly dominating markets, productivity growth overall should be strong. In fact, productivity growth has, as I've mentioned, been slowing down, and not just in Australia. The same patterns of declining business and job dynamism, but rising concentration and profits are evident in the United States and elsewhere. It might not be that the superstar firms were inherently the most productive. It could instead be that barriers to entry have increased. This would line up with reduced rates of business entry, obviously. It would also help explain the decline in business exits, because firms will only clear those barriers and enter if they have a good chance of survival and success. And then facing less of a challenge from entrants, the incumbent firms would see less need to invest, to raise productivity, or to compete for workers by paying attractive salaries. One possible explanation of barriers to entry, declining dynamism, and rising concentration might be that the rate of knowledge diffusion has slowed. This could perhaps be because firm-specific know-how or organisational culture have become more important. But I can't help wondering if the complexity of new technologies, such as machine learning, itself helps create the barrier to entry. The few firms that manage to harness these innovations gain an advantage that other firms can't overcome. The result is a winner-takes-most world of increasing concentration. The question is how much incentive those winners have to keep innovating, to forestall future rivals. There's another possible explanation for these barriers to entry, and both it and the technology-based explanation could be true. It might be that barriers to entry have arisen and dynamism declined because of people's own preferences and decisions. Remember that some of these trends shifted in the aftermath of the GFC. experience of a crisis can shift perceptions of risk and so reduce people's appetite to take risk. As my colleague Brad Jones pointed out a few months ago, the experience of the financial crisis increased the perception of risk and the desire for safety. Some of that desire for safety was a necessary counterbalancing after a period of excessive risk-taking in the global financial sector. But it's entirely plausible that the change in financial behaviour influenced risk perceptions and decisions in the corporate sector more generally. And if perceptions of risk increase, people will want payoffs on investment projects to be further above the cost of finance. And that is exactly what happened. Hurdle rates on investment projects have remained high, even as interest rates and the cost of capital have fallen. This stickiness in hurdle rates is apparent both in Australia and overseas. And again, there are plenty of possible explanations, and more than one of them could be true. Firms might keep their hurdle rates high because they're uncertain what the right hurdle rate should be, or because individual managers don't want to be associated with a failed project. Or perhaps it's because firms only have so much management capacity, so they don't want to commit to a marginal project in case a better one should come along. Another strand of research suggests, again, a role for rising market power and concentration, this time in combination with increased perception of risk. According to this story, hurdle rates have stayed high and investment low, partly because existing firms require these returns because they perceive higher risk. And because everyone perceives risk to be higher, potential rivals don't enter. So the market power of the incumbent firms is preserved. In this dizzying array of interrelated causes, it could be that some are more relevant for multi-decade trends and others for the shift since the GFC. Before turning to the effect of the pandemic, I want to canvass the possibility that the ebb and flow of economic expansion and contraction itself plays a role in business dynamism and related trends. Risk perception might well have increased, but that needs to be balanced against perceived opportunity. New firms will be more likely to enter, and existing firms more likely to invest when they see business opportunities. Workers are more likely to switch jobs if they see plenty of job opportunities and higher pay. And when labour is scarce and no longer cheap, it makes sense to invest in labour-saving technology. By contrast, when conditions are weak, everyone focuses on defending what they have instead of pursuing new opportunities. A scarcity mentality prevails, with cost control and austerity the principal mindset. From this perspective, strong growth and a tight economy could produce a virtuous cycle of more business dynamism, more investment, higher productivity, and higher wages, rather than the supposed creative destruction of a downturn. What is needed is the creative ignition spurred by a strong economy. The weakened financial sector and heightened perceptions of risk following the GFC no doubt made it harder to achieve that virtuous cycle. But perhaps it still would have been attainable if so many economies had not turned so swiftly to fiscal consolidation. If the GFC taught everyone to be more mindful of financial risk, perhaps the pandemic has reminded us about health risks. Ongoing health measures could add to costs, bulk up supply chains, and slow down production processes. Certainly, the prospect of outbreaks disrupting supply chains adds to risk, not just perceptions of it. So it would be understandable to conclude that the post-pandemic world will remain a risk-averse one, with slow growth and subdued dynamism. I'm not sure that this will be the outcome, though, or at least it doesn't have to be. The context is very different. After the GFC, demand was weak and the financial sector itself was constrained. As such, less finance was available even for good but risky projects. This time, demand is bouncing back strongly, supported by policy. Shifts in demand between goods and services have opened up some industry-specific business opportunities, including for new firms. Meanwhile, financial sectors globally are in good shape. Business sectors are also in much better financial shape than they were after the GFC. Profits have recovered quickly, and fiscal support has meant that some firms are considerably more cashed up than before. So the opportunities are there, if not in every industry, and businesses are well placed to fund or finance that investment. Whether the global economy finds itself on a path to a roaring 20s or a post-pandemic malaise depends on the choices that many of us make. These will in turn depend in part on the stories we tell ourselves about the experience and the lessons we learned. And one of the stories we could tell and the lessons we should learn is that actually people and firms can adapt and have done so. This isn't just about the increased use of remote working and teleconferencing, though clearly that's an important part. One can also see increased online sales, new products and services, new suppliers, and an increased focus on what's important, sloughing off the inessential. Even the supply disruptions that are on everyone's mind can turn out to be the constraint that spurred some creativity. One can also see some incredible advances in medical technology, achievements in logistics in many countries' vaccine rollouts, and a newfound data literacy as we all tracked case numbers and vaccine coverage in our news media. Nobody can quite predict what will come from all of that. Now, none of these advances can compensate for the loss of life from the pandemic itself. All the more reason not to compound the tragedy by choosing the path of risk aversion and slow recovery. In taking opportunities, we will always need to be mindful that not everything is in our control. Things never turn out exactly as expected, and it is pointless to wish otherwise. Certainly, there are aspects of life where a craving for zero risk and absolute safety is understandable. In the dynamic realm of business, innovation and investment, though, it is more a case of nothing ventured, nothing gained. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Lucy. There's a lot to unpack there. Before we kick off the discussion, just a reminder to put forward your questions on the Pigeonhole app by going to cedar.pigeonhole.at and using the passcode RBA update, one word, all caps. And we'll endeavour to answer as many questions as possible during the allotted time. So if there's a question you particularly like, make sure you vote for that as well to move it up to the top of the line. To kick things off, I just wanted to pick up on a few of the points that you made. Firstly, you mentioned the lack of dynamism not being unique to Australia, and it was seeing similar trends in a number of countries. I'm just wondering if you could unpack that a bit more, and in particular, whether you have any views on the impact of the low interest rate environment on innovation and risk taking. So on the one hand, it seems obvious that low interest rates make it cheaper for businesses to borrow, and that should be a good thing for investment. But I wonder, on the other hand, if it's contributed to excessive focus by shareholders to chase short-term returns and put pressure on businesses to generate short-term returns, and whether that sometimes comes at the expense of longer-term innovation and investment that takes time to come to fruition and be realised.
Well, thanks, Melissa, and it's a very good question. As I mentioned in my talk, this reduction in dynamism isn't Australia-specific. It seems to be evident in other global economies. And in thinking about the role of low interest rates, you know, in many respects, low interest rates are a consequence of the lack of investment. The saving and investment balance is such that people, you know, are craving safety, so they're saving, but they're not taking opportunities, so there's less investment. And so the thing you need to do to, you know, to get those two things to equalise, which is, you know, what happens in any economy, is that the rate of interest needs to fall. And so that's, you know, I mean, for the technical among us, it's, you know, the decline in R star, the interest rate, the real interest rate you need to get balanced growth in the economy appears to have fallen. And I would say that the interest rate regime is a consequence of that. And then coming back to what I said in my talk, hurdle rates haven't fallen. So that's really telling me that, you know, despite the fact that the cost of capital has come down, the return that businesses are demanding is remaining high.
Mm, I think that's a really good point. You spoke quite a bit about incumbency, and I'm interested in that that point as well, and wondering if, you know, in some ways, are we victims of our own success? You know, at the micro level with the individual superstar firms, they can obviously be well rewarded, as you pointed out. But we also know that successful firms can develop inertia, and that can make it hard for them to see and respond to future opportunities and threats. And then if you look at the macro level, we've had almost three decades until recently of uninterrupted growth. Do you think that's bred some complacency?
Well, Australia has seen three decades of almost uninterrupted growth, but that hasn't been the case in some other countries. So again, this is a global trend, and so we shouldn't look to Australian specific causes. But absolutely, I think there is a sense in which we're seeing increased concentration across a range of industries. It's not obvious that these are necessarily superstar firms. It is really just a story of, you know, incumbency. There's also a huge literature, which I didn't get into in this speech, around the rising profit share, which is another way of saying that margins are increasing. So there is a question about whether that's a benign development. If an increasing profit share and incumbent companies that were, very profitable was engendering more investment and more innovation and more productivity growth, it would be something you could be a bit more comfortable about. But the configuration that Australia and other countries have just doesn't seem to be as benign. So I think that's part of the story.
And on the pandemic, the crisis experience, as you said, businesses have adopted innovations in the space of, weeks or months that would usually take years. What do you think we need to do to sort of harness this momentum outside of crisis periods? And I'm curious to know, the RBA has an extensive liaison program with businesses, whether the liaison program offers any insights into where businesses' minds are at on this front. Earlier in the pandemic, we heard a lot of the mantra of we're going to build back better. Are you hearing that businesses are keen to continue this, or do they feel that they've done enough for now, or are they adopting a wait and see approach given the uncertainties that they're facing?
Well, I don't think there's one sort of consistent message across all our liaison contacts, but the idea that we need to build back better is often used as an argument about something government should do. And as I pointed out in my talk, we can't point to changes in regulation in one country to explain this. This is a global phenomenon. So it seems to me that it does actually come down to, self-belief and, let's try and work out what it was that enabled us to make those changes during a crisis. And, can we ensure that we can make those kinds of changes without the same level of inertia? I think, honestly, it is about risk. During crisis times, you're willing to say, well, if this doesn't work perfectly, it's okay because it's better than the alternative. Whereas when times are a little bit more benign, people say, oh, no, we want to take the time to get it right. Some of it has to be about the incentives that people face. As I mentioned in my talk, nobody wants to be associated with a failed project. And so I think that does create a certain level of inertia. People are much more likely to be sacked for being associated with a failed project than they are for not taking an opportunity that nobody else took either.
Yeah, there's some interesting research on the risk aversion front, looking at the differences between risk appetites at different levels within organisations, and that the CEOs take a portfolio view, but the individual managers beneath them can be really risk averse and feel like they're betting their career on each decision, and they're not willing to put forward that risky, bold, neck on the line idea. So risk aversion is something that has come up a lot when we've been discussing business dynamism and innovation with CETA members. Just looking at the questions that are coming in thick and fast from the audience, and the one that's received the most votes so far, people are really keen to hear your views, Lucy, on whether there are regulatory barriers to business dynamism in Australia.
Well, Melissa, thanks. Yes, I saw that one getting all the votes too. And I think this really speaks to the point I was making in my speech. Instead of looking to whether or not businesses are taking opportunities and the incentives that individuals within organisations are facing, there is a tendency to say, oh, well, it must be something the government's doing or not doing, and that the fix comes from government. And as I said in my speech, this is a global phenomenon. We can't look at particular countries' regulation and say, well, that's the story, because it's common to all sorts of different countries with different regulatory setups.
Absolutely. And what do you see as the role of the RBA in encouraging dynamism and risk-taking?
Well, for those of you who've read the text, it does feel a little bit rich for someone who spent 30 years at the central bank to be telling people, you know, to take a risk and be innovative. I do have an innovators award, but that's a bit of a long story. I think all we can really do is, you know, provide a stable economy, a deal of certainty, be clear about what we're planning to do and the decision-making framework that we use to make, that the board makes to, uses to make its decisions. And I think maybe, you know, a few speeches here and there, that really is all we can do.
At the end of the day, interest rates are a blunt instrument, right? There's a few questions in here on leadership capabilities and management capabilities, which I'm very excited to see because that's an area that CEDA has been thinking a lot about. We've been looking at the research on management capabilities and that they really, really matter. One study, for example, has shown that, you know, half of the productivity gap between Australia and the US can be accounted for by differences in management capabilities. And in particular at CEDA, we're focusing our attention on dynamic capabilities that businesses need to thrive in an uncertain environment. So I'm going to give a shameless plug for the survey we're currently undertaking to assess the dynamic capabilities of Australian businesses and encourage all the business leaders listening to the call today to get in touch and participate in this research. So what do you think about the role of leadership capabilities and the role of government in encouraging those capabilities of Australian firms? That's some of the questions coming in to that effect.
Well, again, I mean, we keep saying, what can government do to make businesses do what surely businesses have the financial incentive to do? I mean, if it is indeed the case, and I admit, Melissa, I'm not familiar with this literature, but if it is indeed the case that Australian businesses lack management capability that American businesses have, you know, why aren't we sending people to learn from them? Why, you know, why are businesses leaving that on the table? There's a question. There's an ungapped, you know, an unbridged gap there that I really just struggle to understand. Why would businesses, you know, leave that money on the table by not investing in management capability?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Two points on that I've seen in the literature. One is that you're absolutely right that, you know, international diffusion of ideas and exposure to international ideas, whether that's through being part of multinational corporations or experience overseas or exposure to export markets, do seem to have a correlation with higher management capabilities. So there's definitely a role for that international exposure. The other really interesting, well, I found it really interesting part of that literature is that there doesn't seem to be a very, there's not really a correlation between what managers think that their capabilities are at and their independently assessed capabilities. So there seems to be a bit of a blind spot there for businesses. So that's something for businesses to consider is, you know, working out first of all where they're up to and identifying ways in which they can improve, because it does make a difference. Another question coming through that's received a lot of votes, Lucy, is could rising levels of household indebtedness be contributing to the reduced willingness of workers to move between jobs? You showed that really stark graph with the job mobility decline since the 70s. Has household indebtedness got anything to do with that?
Thanks, Melissa. It's an important point. I can understand a world in which people facing the need to make their mortgage repayments might be a bit reluctant to do something particularly risk-taking like start their own business. But I would have thought that if you have a big mortgage, you'd be more willing to take a new job that offers higher pay. So I think what this is telling you is that, you know, one of the things that makes, you know, there are two things that make people leave their jobs. There are socioeconomic reasons, like, you know, their family are moving, or, you know, they're looking for more career progression. But primarily there are two reasons why people leave a job. One is because they hate their boss, and the other is because they got an offer that was significantly better pay and more career opportunities than the job they left. They might have been happy in the job they left, but they were offered, you know, they were able to get a better job. And so it seems to me that the, you know, the missing link here is firms' willingness to actually increase wages. And particularly in Australia, but also globally, we saw what in the profession we would call a very flat Phillips curve. It really took a lot to start seeing a tight enough labour market before firms started increasing wage offers. And so it's that willingness to increase wage offers that may well be the issue, or at least part of it.
Related to, on the topic of the labour market, there's a question here about whether you think skills shortages are holding back businesses that want to be innovative and risk-taking.
Well, a skill shortage is simply that nobody wants the job at the wage that you're offering, and there is a really simple solution to that. And similarly, I think, what tends to happen as labour markets tighten is that firms start being a bit less precise in their requirements and show a willingness to hire someone who may need some training rather than expecting someone who is fully cooked saying, oh, well, I only want someone with 2 years experience now rather than 5 years. And it's quite common. I mean, you go onto some of these job sites and there'll be quite a lot of discussion and opinion columns saying, well, all these firms, they say it's an entry-level position, but they want 6 years of experience and a PhD and whatever. And so what happens is over time, the mismatch between firms' expectations and what the market is requiring to induce someone to change jobs finally comes in, closer into line.
One more on the labour market before we move on. There's been a lot of votes on a question. This one's from Catherine Domansky about whether you can comment on the likelihood of a great resignation. I presume she means the likelihood in Australia. We've obviously heard a lot about this topic coming from overseas. How applicable do you think it is here?
Yeah, I'm really, thank you, Catherine, for asking this question because it does give me the opportunity to address it. Through last year, we saw a greatly reduced rate of people leaving their job voluntarily to switch jobs because, again, during times of uncertainty, they hang on. I fully expect there will be a little bit of catch-up through the second half of this year and into next year as people who might otherwise have left their jobs back then are doing it now. So there'll be a little bit of catch-up. But I don't think we're in the same situation as the United States. And to be honest, this is really mostly a United States story where, a lot of what is going on is that frontline workers, people who are relatively lowly paid, have, experienced, being locked down, experienced being, they didn't even get furloughed, or they didn't have JobKeeper, they were put on unemployment benefits. So firstly, you've got to stitch everything back together. But I think the very different experience that many lower paid Americans experienced relative to here in Australia in terms of the support they received and the way we handled the health situation, I think that's just going to be a very different experience. That the wage rates at the lower end in the US are very low, and I think a lot of people are saying, why am I doing this for this rate of pay? And that shock leads them to expect something, to look for something a bit better rather than staying put. Whereas in Australia, because of JobKeeper, there wasn't that immediate shakeout, and so you don't have that experience of, people being sort of forced to reconsider their status quo in the same way that Americans who are more likely to be laid off rather than kept on in the same circumstances because they didn't have JobKeeper.
Moving on from the labour market, one question here is a broader one about whether there are particular industries or sectors that have been particularly affected by a lack of dynamism. Do you have any insights on the breakdown there?
My understanding of the literature is that it's pretty broad-based. There's no one industry that you can really sort of highlight as being most affected by this.
One industry that's obviously received a lot of attention over the COVID period has been the higher education industry. And there's a question here asking whether higher education has a role to play in encouraging knowledge diffusion, innovation and adaptation. It's something that's on the federal government's mind. They've got the University Research Commercialisation Task Force underway. Universities are potentially more open to these ideas. What are your views on the higher education sector?
I think the higher education sector has a big and important role to play in encouraging innovation and dynamism. And in fact, if you look at the patents that come out of Australia, some combination of the CSIRO and universities are very highly ranked relative to the sort of non-mining, non-gambling corporate sector.
One of the interesting statistics it seems to be that we're very good at coming up with new ideas, but not so good at translating those new ideas and new knowledge into new products and outputs. So that's a challenge in Australia, at least in terms of our journey on the dynamism innovation front compared to some of the other OECD countries. On this topic of knowledge diffusion, there's a question here from Angelina Bruno. She said Treasury, and she's referenced Megan Quinn in 2019, identified widening productivity dispersion. The question has moved. I might come back. Oh, there it is. Apologies. Yeah, Treasury identified widening productivity dispersion amongst firms as an indicator of slowing knowledge diffusion. And should innovation policy focus more on diffusion rather than creation?
Well, it's well outside the remit of a central bank to say what innovation policy should look like. But I think what the work that Megan is citing and among some of which comes out of Treasury and which I've cited, what that research is saying is that you do need to pay attention to both. It's about diffusion and creation.
Absolutely. Coming back to some of the comments you made about risk tolerance and opportunity, I found really interesting. And one thing I've been thinking about there is the distinction between risk and risk tolerance versus uncertainty. So whether it's that firms have become more risk averse or they're just finding it harder to make those cost benefit assessments in the usual manner because there's a large degree of uncertainty and it's hard to put probabilities on potential outcomes. CETA members have definitely been telling us that the outlook is more uncertain and rapidly changing, and you can point to numerous examples of that in terms of the digital transformation that you touched on and also the climate revolution. Do you have any thoughts on this risk versus uncertainty distinction?
I think it's an important thing to highlight that uncertainty is actually what we're talking about in many respects. I mean, they are two different concepts, risk being one where you're assigning probabilities to things and uncertainty where you're really just not sure. But, businesses understand about decision-making under uncertainty. They understand that markets can shift. If you look at any of the business literature, nothing comes down to a regression or a probability statement. It's, well, what could happen to this industry? How do you know, when you should be paying attention to the possibility of a change in trend? So I think it's an important distinction conceptually, but it may not be as important in practice.
And I think that's where some of these dynamic capabilities that we've been thinking about really come in. That's very much focused on operating in an uncertain world. So we're interested to see whether firms in Australia have those capabilities to sense and seize opportunities in an uncertain environment and really harness some of those opportunities that are coming their way. So it'll be interesting to see our findings on that front. On the topic of risk aversion, there's a question here from Sophia Rodriguez, and she's asking, if the post-pandemic world is unlikely to be a risk-averse one, as you suggest, what impact would this have on growth, and have you factored this possibility into your forecasts or in your upside scenarios?
I think the way I would respond to that is to make it clear that although we publish scenarios that are specific to particular configurations of how things could turn out differently, we also have an extensive segment in our statement on monetary policy where we talk about other risks and uncertainties. And of course, these are the kinds of issues that we're grappling with when we put our forecast together. But oftentimes, these are things that are more a 3 to 5 year, to 10 years, issue, more so than the next year or two, which is what our published forecasts really cover.
Now, I don't think you'd really expect to get out of this without a housing question, Lucy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of votes here for this question, an anonymous question. Linking housing back to investment more broadly, the question is, has the propensity for housing investment in Australia reduced the appetite for investment in productive capital?
Yes, you're right. I couldn't get away with that one. And so the first point I'd make in response to that is, again, these are global trends we're talking about. And so it's hard to ascribe what we're seeing and what I described in my speech as having anything particularly Australian specific. There may be some Australian specific factors at work. One thing I should point out is, of course, why do we actually build homes? It's to house our population. And because Australia has, until very recently, had much stronger population growth than other countries, you kind of have to keep building more incremental housing relative to the size of your housing stock with high population growth than if you have low or no population growth. So in many respects, that's just an artifact of the growth in population. I think one other thing that people haven't really sort of taken account of more recently is if we're talking about work from home and increased hybrid work modes, that means that the home you live in is now also a workplace. And for all the sort of discussion of housing being an unproductive asset, well, it isn't now, it's a workplace. And so I think that line becomes a lot more blurred now, and particularly in terms of people focusing on having a larger home with a home office, demand for renovation, I think you'll see that aspect become part of the story. But a lot of that may well be, you know, the changing nature of the home as a place of work.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. You mentioned there, and it's a theme that's come through this discussion, that this is a global phenomenon that we're seeing at the moment. So there's a question here about whether there have been policies in other countries that have been effective in improving dynamism overseas.
I would struggle to point to a particular innovation. And again, we seem to be always saying, well, here's an issue, what can the government do about it and what policies can happen? And, you know, a lot of the theme here is about, this is about decisions that businesses make regardless of the landscape and how they view the opportunities that they face rather than seeing everything in terms of constraint. And this is the mindset issue that I talked about in my speech. This issue of dynamism is really only been a relatively recently observed phenomenon in the literature. It is unpicking what's going on has relied on new data sets that have often been quite, you know, only become available recently. There's been some really good work coming out of the OECD and out of the Australian Treasury on some of this. So I think people are still grappling with what to do about it.
Some of that work's been quite positive. Dan Andrews and the Treasury Accenture work you spoke about has shown that high productivity firms were more resilient and more likely to expand during the pandemic. So that's a positive news story for Australia. So that's good to see. We've got a question here about confidence in business investment in Australia. So Lisa Liang has asked, she's noted that the foreign superannuation funds from the US and Canada have been entering the Australian market, particularly M&A in agriculture, and whether that's a sign that post-COVID-19 confidence in businesses in Australia has returned. What are your thoughts on that?
It's the role of these large fund managers, whether pension funds or any other large fund manager, to diversify their assets. So, of course, those investors will be looking for opportunities in Australia as well as elsewhere. I mean, we are a country that offers a great deal of opportunity. We have, you know, a highly educated workforce. We have resources, we have good infrastructure, we have a really good legal framework. It's a very attractive place to invest relative to some other alternatives. And so it doesn't surprise me that foreign investors would see this, and it wouldn't surprise me if Australian investors are seeing this. So whether that's a particular post-pandemic thing or whether it is just simply what has already gone on before in terms of global funds managers looking for opportunities globally, it would be hard for me to say.
Yeah, and some of those factors that you mentioned just there, perhaps some of the strengths that might help Australia when it comes to dynamism and innovation, you know, and things like, you know, a natural resource endowment and educated population come to mind. But there are some weaknesses as well in terms of, you know, perhaps people point to things like geographical isolation and relatively small domestic market. What do you think are some of the strengths and weaknesses for Australian businesses when it comes to innovation?
Well, again, I do think, you know, we have a highly educated population. We have a good institutional framework. Absolutely, we are more distant from the rest of the world, but we're now in a world where so many of the products and services that we are consuming are not really dependent on distance. I mean, I'm always, you know, amazed to find which of the software apps on my various devices are from you know, quite small countries in Europe, for example, and the amount of independent development that we see and that we are seeing in Australia as well. So I think increasingly we will start seeing people realise that, you know, the tyranny of distance isn't quite such a tyranny anymore.
Indeed. Another theme that's come through this discussion has been the role of government, or perhaps, you know, too much expectation placed on the role of government. There's a question here that says, well, if government doesn't have as much of a role to play, how do you change the mindset of businesses around investment decisions?
I wish I knew the answer to that question, but I've given it a red hot go today.
It's a million dollar question, isn't it?
More than $1 million.
Now, we're not focusing on interest rates and the path of interest rates today, and the governor did speak about that on Tuesday, but we have had a few questions coming through on that, so I'll give you an opportunity if you want to take that or pass on that question.
Well, I would refer back to what the governor said on Tuesday. We also published the minutes on Tuesday. Nothing has changed in the last 2 days to make me want to change that message.
Absolutely. I might just finish off with one last question, and this idea about laggards versus leaders, which you touched on. We know we have some firms operating at the frontier and others that are lagging behind, and that the productivity gap between the two has widened. Do you think we're better off focusing our efforts on helping more laggard businesses to get closer to that productivity frontier, or should we be taking a similar approach to New Zealand and focusing on capabilities that will push the Australian frontier out further, focusing on those frontier firms in the hope that a rising tide lifts all boats?
I think the important issue is that today's frontier firm may not remain the frontier firm of tomorrow, and that's actually one of the findings from the OECD literature, that the firm that is the frontier or the superstar isn't necessarily going to remain the superstar for forever. And so focusing on more general capabilities and, you know, seeing where the cards fall, I think is likely to be quite fruitful in this particular regard.
Well, let's see, we're very hot on capabilities, so that's a nice note to finish up on. Thank you so much, Lucy. We're out of time, so we'll leave it there for today. On behalf of everybody on the call, I'd like to thank our guest speaker today, Dr. Lucy Ellis, for generously sharing her time and insights on this important topic. And thank you also to everyone for participating in the discussion today. It's been some really great questions come through. Just a reminder that this session has been recorded